All right, we are continuing in Genesis. We barely touched the surface here in Genesis chapter 6. We looked at a couple of the first few verses that are here, but we haven't gone much further than that. Let's see, we looked at chapter 6, Noah's world. The world is covered in sin right now. We see that in chapter 4, the escalation of sin, and in chapter 6, it escalates to the point where there is so much violence that the Lord has regretted making mankind. Can you imagine how terrible it must have been in order for that situation to be, for that outcome to have occurred? We talked about some possibilities for the sons of God and the daughters of men and what that might be. And it's not something that we can hash out to any degree, but the main point, of course, is that God is capable of handling all these things and all these big problems that seem insurmountable. And so he has that capability, and he will take care of it if it is his will. We talked about the giants and the Nephilim that kind of go along with that. And now, there is one thing I didn't mention last time, with regard to that, and that is this phrase in verse 3. And I know there are some disagreements that I've had with some people about that, but I'd like to hear some thoughts to consider what exactly this is talking about. My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. What does that mean? There's two possibilities that I have come across for what that means. And I'd like to hear some thoughts. What does that mean?
Well, one possibility is you're dealing here with people who are living an extremely long time, getting up towards 900 years, 1,000 years, whatever. And we don't have that anymore. So there's, what we have now is a world where people are maxed out at 120 years. Nobody lives longer than that. And it's an interesting coincidence. You can't say that's what it means because it just says it here. And of course, the other explanation is an equally interesting one as well.
Yeah.
But it does coincide with the fact that he's talking about, I will not strive with man forever, for he is flesh. And some translations say, for he is mortal.
Yeah.
And that, so the context of it being talking about extreme long life and God having to struggle with a person, for hundreds of years in their wickedness.
And that, at least in context. Yeah, and that is a possibility. So one of the possibilities for those on the live stream is that man doesn't live longer than 120 years. I do have a couple problems with that. First off, he does, after Genesis 6. When we get to Genesis 11, mankind's lifespan does shorten, but it, for many cases, it's longer than 120. And so it's not a sudden fall off, first of all, at least in terms of suddenly dropping to 120. It is sudden in terms of it suddenly drops, but not to that. Plus, we see in a couple other places, in Exodus chapter 6, where we see a few people, Levi and Amram, living to 130, 133 years old. Aaron himself lives to 123. And Jehoiada, we mentioned him in our sermon last week, lived to 130. And he's all the way in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. So I'm not sure I entirely... But plus, in modern day, there has been someone recorded to have lived 122 years. And that's the oldest on record in modern day. So I'm not entirely sure I agree with the idea that 120 is the age limit that we can reach. I think it's an interesting thing to consider, but I don't think that quite answers that evidence. So the alternative is that this is 120 years before the flood where he makes this pronouncement. How long did it take Noah to build the ark? Do we remember?
I think 10 years.
little longer than that. A little longer than that. It took him 100 years to build it. He says in chapter 5, verse 30, that he lived 32, and Noah was 500 years old, and he begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then a little bit later, it says he was 600 whenever he boarded the ark. So he took 100 years to build this thing. Wow. Which means God had made this pronouncement 20 years before he made the command for Noah to build this ark, to start building this thing. So it does fit. That does kind of fit the whole thing. And mankind is flesh. That could just refer to the fact that he is flesh. And in fact, we are flesh. And we'll eventually end up dying in the flood. Or can die at the very least.
We have a sinful nature also.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a... All right. All right, so that is where I end up on that. And then we can look at a little bit more. There is some destruction coming. We see in verses 5-7, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. Again, can you imagine? I mean, does God love us? Does God love humanity? Yes. He loves us so much he sent his son to die for us. And yet, can you imagine how hard it must have been on him at this point to say, I'm sorry I've made them. I'm sorry I've made them. For those of you who are parents, which is most of the people in here, have you ever gotten to the point when you've had your kids and you're like, and they've been acting a fool, you're like, I'm sorry I ever made you. I'm sorry I ever had a part in that. Well, I don't think any of us would have. We all love our children and we all care for them. Not to say that there's anything wrong with what God is saying, of course, but the fact that he said that must imply, I mean, can you imagine, what would you say if you had a child and that child happened to be a mass murderer, a serial killer, a criminal of the highest degree, a terrorist, or something to that degree, to that extent? What would you think? Yes, Stan.
I'd probably say what I have said and what my mother said, which was, I hope each and every one of you have children just like you. That's the greatest curse a parent can put upon their child.
Well, hopefully not if you're a serial killer. That would be, you don't want more of those. But yeah, I get the idea. Yeah, yeah, and so we have disobedience in our kids. I mean, that's every parent has a kid who's disobedient, who has something that they do that you don't like. But to the extent that you're sorry, I mean, that has to be tough. That has to be strong. To the extent that he I've got to put a stop to this. God says all the violence that's happening right there, all the murders and all the bloodshed that is happening, God's got to put a stop to it. These are my kids. This is my responsibility. I've got to handle this. I hate that I have to do this, but I've got to take care of it. Yes.
So a couple of things. First of all, we still have the omniscience of God. So the Bible tells us that before the creation, Christ's sacrifice was in the mind of God. Right, so he knew what he was going to have to do. it also tells us about the nature of free will. That free will is in fact free. And of course it tells us about man and what we're likely to do. But it also tells us about that God is not aloof. You know, that he has real feelings, and that he had to experience the rebellion of his creation and of his children, and that brought him sorrow and pain. Even though he's omniscient, even though he planned for the redemption of man before, even he knew he was going to have to send his son to die on the cross, the experience of rebellion of those creatures that carried his image and his spirit hurt him.
I mean, it shows that he's not aloof, for those on the live stream. That's what Sam is saying, to show that he isn't just some detached deity up there in heaven not caring what we do. It shows that he does care what we do, that he does love us so much, and the nature of free will. He loves us so much that he can't... So if you have a dispute between your children, and it comes to the point where one is about to kill the other, you're going to stop the one who's about to kill the other, right? And so that's what God is trying to do. He's trying to put a stop to the violence. And that's what we see here on... Is the world violent today? I don't know if it's as violent as it was back then, but at least God hasn't come and destroyed us yet. So maybe there's some hope there. But we have... violence is something that he hates. He hates it. And so let us... we're all made in his image. Let us love one another in that regard. All right. The destruction is coming, but at verse 8, there's hope. Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. He finds grace. That's remarkable, isn't it? There's hope. And in fact, it harkens back to chapter 5 and verse 29. And he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." The ground which the Lord has cursed will be hurt even more by this flood that's coming, but there is hope in Noah. There is hope in him. Then it talks about his genealogy a little bit. Genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. He walked with God, just like Enoch walked with God, right? In chapter 5, verse 22, Enoch walked with God 300 years. And now I wonder, Enoch probably, now this is just a random thought, Enoch may have been, if the world was wicked enough by the time of Enoch, maybe Enoch would have been the new Noah. Who knows? I don't know. Or the Noah by that point would have been the one to have made the ark and all that. But again, that's just speculation. By the time of Noah, we see that the world is so wicked, so disastrous. He begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So, again, talking about that, the end of all flesh, hearkening back to verse 3. For he is indeed flesh, and his days will be 120 years. So, I will indeed destroy them with the earth. He's going to destroy us with the earth that he has made. And, of course, that is true. We find that later with the flood, the destruction there. And then a new section I've got up here, the flood, chapter 6, verse 14, all the way to chapter 9, verse 17. The ark is constructed. We find the instructions given here in verses 14 through 21. The ark is constructed. Many of us are familiar with the construction, the materials used. Gopher wood. What is gopher wood? Who knows? Gopher is a transliteration of the Hebrew word gopher. So we have no idea what gopher wood was.
Gopher wood in Oregon.
Well, they might have named it that, and
it was the same as what was in the Palestine.
Well, we don't know if Noah was in Palestine. We don't know where he was. But there is some speculation that it may have been cedar of some kind, but like the cedars of Lebanon, something to that effect. I don't know.
There's obviously some engineering issues about it because in my reference here, it says that it may have been cypress.
There are some cypress. Maybe that's what I was thinking of, cypress.
There's some wood that doesn't waterlog when it's soaked in water for a long time, and that would be a very important attribute of a building material for something that's going to be in the water for so long.
Yeah, maybe that's what I was thinking of. I know it was a C wood that has an S sound, cypress or cedar. But thank you. So it could have been any of those pieces, any bit of wood. We really don't know what gopher wood was. If we did, I'm sure some of the modern translations would have come up with another word for it. But we don't know. Also, it says using pitch. That is understood to be bitumen, which is, there are some bitumen pits. It's like tar pits around the area of the Dead Sea, at the very least. And I'm sure there's others in some other places. But, you know, it's used to go on the outside of ships in order to keep them from leaking. Kind of the idea you were talking about, keeping them from being waterlogged, things of that nature. Materials, and then we see the dimensions are here as well. It's a pretty large ship, one of the largest ever created by mankind up to a certain point, up until the 20th century at the very least. But what we have an idea in our heads often of what this ark looked like, and sometimes we have something like that. We get inundated with these pictures when we're kids, and we sometimes get this cartoonish idea of what the ark looked like. And we might have this picture in our heads or something like that, where all the animals are having a great old time on the deck, maybe a little bit below, and poking their heads out like out of the roof, or maybe something similar like that, and Noah's just hanging out, having fun, man. He was on that boat for a year. Don't you think he'd have gotten a little stir crazy? I mean, how many of us got stir crazy while we were in our homes in the quarantine? Pam's like, I didn't get stir crazy. but many of us did. And so with eight people there, I'm sick of seeing these eight people. I mean, I love you, but I want to see more. So it gets to that point, right? We have a certain unique perspective these days about that kind of situation that Noah was in, and it certainly, by the end of it, maybe he was smiling like that. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was just, all right, let's go. Let's get this over with. Who knows? Who knows what he was like? And then this funny cartoonish one where these beavers are eating the side of the boat. Of course, you have to wonder what the termites were doing on the boat there. Maybe they don't eat gopher wood. I don't know. But we get this cartoonish idea sometimes. But really, this is closer to what it looked like. And I really like this image because it gives you an idea in football fields. And I know that I hate that Alvin's not here. I know Alvin loves to see how things look like in terms of a football field. So it's about a football field and a half in terms of length, maybe a little longer. And in height, you can see you could sit comfortably in a stadium, at least height-wise anyway, and width-wise, but not length-wise. It's quite a little shorter than that. The stadium is a little shorter than that. So you can see some interesting dimensions there. Now it gives the measurements in cubits. There were several different kinds of cubits that they had back then. The one that's typically we find in the Bible is 18 inches. It's measured from the elbow to the tip of the finger, right? And of course, for everyone, that's different, but it was standardized to about 18 inches, what we would consider that, about a foot and a half. The Egyptian one was a little bit longer, and some people think that that one is preferred over the Israelite one. And maybe it is. It's really hard to say which one is preferred. But this is using the Israelite measurement for a cubit, 450 feet. I know this one is a little bit grainy, but I like it because it gives a comparison. I like it for a couple of reasons. One, that I think is probably one of the most realistic looking pictures or images of the Ark, where it's just this block, basically, because that's what the dimensions suggest here in the Bible. It also gives some comparisons to other creatures. Can dinosaurs fit on that, the largest dinosaurs? Yeah. We can see it can fit. Those big sauropods can fit on there. We also see elephants and giraffes are fairly small compared to it. It's got three decks, and maybe there's some holes in some of the decks so that it can fit some of the larger sauropods. Who knows? And some suggest that they carry it on their children for the larger animals or juveniles. And maybe that's the case. We also see, of course, a comparison to a 747. For those of you who are familiar with the size of that airplane, I don't know. This is a picture of a reconstruction there. Y'all familiar with that? That one there? That's the one in Kentucky that they built at the Creation Museum there. And it is, I've not been to it yet. I've been meaning to, hopefully, wanting the kids to be a little bit older so they'll remember the experience. But I have a picture up here. They use the Egyptian cubit for the dimensions because they prefer that one for some reason. I put it up here because they have a comparison to humans and how big a human is to this ark. Boy, that's a big ship, isn't it? It's a big ship. All right. Oh, and I like this one because it shows the three decks and what's likely in these decks. The second deck two looks like it's got all the storage supplies and whatnot, and some things on this first deck, this top deck, and this little lower deck. You know, one of the interesting things is that in a lot of depictions, the ark has many windows, but how many windows did the ark have?
One door.
Well, it's one door and
one
window. It says it has one window. Now, the window, looking at the instructions that are here presented in this in the Bible here, it seems like that this is a good representation in terms of what that window looked like. Let me back up a little bit. Because you have here, this, it looks like several windows, but these are just supports. This is one window at the top and something covering it, because that's the indication here in Genesis. So that is, that's verse 16. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make with it lower deck, lower second and third decks. Where's the covering? Yeah. It does mention a covering at some point. I can't find it right now. But it does mention a covering that's placed on the top of it. And that is what you see right there. It's not on that one. Well, that's not a good picture of that. But yeah, that's what you see up there, that covering. So that's that one window there. It's not several windows like you see in some depictions, or several doors like some have.
But you had air conditioning. If you had a window that big and you were out at sea in lots of storms,
yeah,
you would not have any problem with ventilation.
You would need ventilation, yeah, definitely.
The wind would be blowing through that constantly.
I mean, it smells like a farm in there, no doubt. So you want to have some kind of way to air that out some, right?
It's actually not that bad. If you've ever spent a lot of time in a barn, you can deal with it.
Well, okay. I'll take your word for that. All right. This is judgment that is coming. This is a judgment. And the judgment is, again, because of, let's see, instructions, obedience. So we talked about judgment, instructions, obedience already. So, or judgment and instructions. Obedience is the last one here. Obedience. Verse 22, thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Again, bringing comfort, right? Obedience of Noah, the obedience that he has brought to the world so that mankind can be saved. Of course, we have that bit of a genetic bottleneck at this point, because everyone on earth is destroyed except for these eight souls. We see every animal on earth is destroyed except for two of each kind that has been made. And that's powerful. That's powerful. That Noah is the only one at this time to have obeyed the Lord. All right. That one all comes at once for a good reason. I might have time to get through this. The flood waters come, we see in chapters 7 and 8. And this is the entire flood here, all the way up to verse 14 of chapter 8. The ark is boarded here at the beginning of verse 7. The earth is flooded, and we see some indication of what that means there in Psalm 104, verses 6 through 9. All the upheavals, the valleys, the mountains that are formed as a result of the flood. Eventually, the waters recede, and the birds are sent, and the earth is dried. And that's the basic outline for what happens in the flood. And we're actually given timestamps, time markers for each of these events. And I didn't talk about this with the chronology class because I wasn't that detailed when I was doing Genesis. But just some interesting things to consider. Timeline of the flood. So it begins at 1656 AM, or Anno Mundi, year of the world, after the creation. 1656, 1657, depending on how you count that, if there's a year zero or not. So that is when it occurs. After we're here for over 1,500 years when the destruction happens. Then we see I have that approximately 2327 BC. There's some, it could be a couple hundred years from that. You know, there's some leeway there in terms of that. Because of the looking at the chronology, there are a couple places where you can fit in a couple hundred years. Not thousands, but maybe a hundred or two. All right. So it starts on the 10th day of the second month. What is that? Faofi? Oh, let me tell you, this took a bit of research here. So, there is an indication in chapter 7, chapter 7. And chapter 8, verse 4. One says 150 days for from a particular point, and the other one says the seventh month, the 17th day of that month. All right, so this is an indication that we're not talking about a lunar calendar. So a lunar calendar, and so what that means, a lunar calendar has 30 days, 29 days, 39, 30 days, 29 days. We're not talking about the Israelite calendar because it's a few days off. And I noticed this a while back when I wasn't even considering this, and I put it in the my calculator to decide, oh, how many days would this be in our calculator? And it worked out perfectly using our calendar. What calendar, what kind of calendar do we use, lunar or solar? We use a solar calendar, right? And so it works perfectly with a solar calendar, which is an indication that this is that Noah has recorded things, or Moses is recording this using whatever Noah used, which is a solar calendar. The of the ancient peoples, there are a couple of different ways, but in that area, the Egyptians used a solar calendar. And there's different reasons for that, mainly because the coinciding with the flooding of the Nile and all that. So this is the second month of the Egyptian calendar, Phaophi, if I'm pronouncing that right. I have no idea. And this is the 10th day. Now, it doesn't say the 10th day, but it does say that that the flood starts on the 17th day of the second month. So, and then they started boarding a week before, 7 days before. So the 10th day of the second month. Now, trying to figure out how that fits into our calendar at that year, not easy. I'm probably wrong, but in terms of how we understand how long being in this situation, we can look at, okay, May the 6th, and we can see, okay, the next one is May the 13th. We can see, have some idea of how long they've been in the ark and how long each of these things are. So it gives us some clue for how it might have felt being in that ark. All right, so the animals and the people board. Then the flood begins on the 17th day of the second month, about May 13th for us. The flood begins, rains for 40 days, 40 nights. The rain ends the 27th day of the third month, June 22nd approximately. 17th day of the seventh month, the waters begin to recede and the ark rests at Ararat about October 10th. So that's some time, isn't it? June to October. May to October, as the waters begin to recede. First day of the 10th month, around December 23rd, the tops of the mountains can be seen. The 11th day of the 11th month, around February 1st. So it starts in May, and the raven is sent in February. 7 days later. Now there's an indication in the New King James, it's kind of nebulous as to if it's a week later that the dove is sent, but in other translations it's fairly clear that it's a week later the first dove is sent. So the raven is sent first, then the dove, the first dove is sent around February 8th. 7 days later, February 15th, second dove, third dove on the around February 22nd. What's the significance of sending these doves, or these birds?
They're homing pigeons. They're supposed to find land and bring proof that there's land.
Yeah, well, the doves certainly are, or to some extent anyway.
They can't swim.
Pardon?
They can't swim.
They can't swim. But the raven will find... They're scavengers, so they might have found some floating body or something somewhere that they found, and they scavenged upon it. Possibly, maybe it drowned out there. Who knows? But it didn't come back. The dove went off and came back. Didn't find anything. The second dove, what happened to the second dove? Brought back something. What did it bring back?
A branch.
Yeah, an olive branch, a little olive branch, right? Which means, suggests that olive trees, because how long does it take an olive tree to do that? It takes a while, doesn't it? So that means that some olive trees survived the flood. Which means that in some places, the flood caused a whole lot of upheaval, and in some places it may not have. Make sense? All right. So there is second doves had the olive tree brought back, showing that there is some sign of life out there. The third dove sent doesn't come back, which is an indication that, because it would have come back, because that first and second dove came back, that third one didn't come back, an indication that there's some place for it to be, which brings hope to the inhabitants of the ark, to the eight people who were there. And then the first day of the first month, around March 28th, the local area is dry, but the Lord says, not yet. Stay on the ark for a little while longer. Nearly 2 months longer, because near the end of the second month, May 23rd, the earth is totally dry, and they disembark. And it ends a year after it begins, a little over a year, around 2326 BC, according to my calculation. So it could be a couple hundred years off, depending on how you measure the chronology. All right. So that's the timeline of the flood. Gives you some idea of what happened there. That covers chapters 6 and 7. There are a couple things I want to talk about after that. Is it a global or a local flood? We'll talk about that next week. That's going to be fun, huh? All right. We're out of time, so we'll dismiss and we'll have our worship in a little while.